In just a moment, Jerome Kern, the man and his music. But first, how long since you've read a good bestseller or enjoyed a performance of the theater or met some really stimulating people? Well, you can do all these things tomorrow and every Monday through Friday and without neglecting your daily routine either. Yes, it's weekday, NBC's wonderful daytime radio service, bringing right into your own home a new novel, First Train to Babylon, another complete short story, and interesting guest personalities, singer John Raitt, composer Robert Russell Bennett, and many others. You'll hear it all on weekday tomorrow. Now stay tuned for Jerome Kern, the man and his music on NBC.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Jerome Kern, the man and the music, an NBC News biography in sound. What you're listening to is some of the most memorable popular music of our century. In the next 55 transcribed minutes, you'll hear more of that music and more about Jerome Kern, the man who wrote it, told in the voices of those who knew him best. Among Kern's closest friends was his arranger, Robert Russell Bennett.
I think I've seen Kern in practically every aspect in the world, and of course it would be silly for me to say I ever understood him, because I didn't.
Another close friend was the playwright and lyricist Oscar Hammerstein II.
Jerry called me up and said he had read half of a book, and he thought it would be great for us. And I said, what book is that? And he said, Edna Ferber's Showboat.
Rare book expert Tony Bade knew Kern best through a hobby.
Jerome Kern was well known and greatly loved by most of the booksellers of America. And it has always been said that when he found an item he liked, he never haggled on the price.
And Edna Ferber shared with Kern a never-to-be-forgotten moment.
He played and sang the music he had just written. The music mounted, mounted, and I give you my word, my hair stood on end. Tears came to my eyes. I knew that this wasn't just a musical comedy number.
In just a moment, you'll share these and other recollections of Jerome Kern. First, a message from RCA and RCA Victor.
Hello, this is Vaughn Monroe for RCA. If you own an RCA Victor television, let me introduce you to a man you can depend on for continuous top performance.
I'm an RCA service company technician, and as Vaughn says, it's my job to keep America's finest television sets delivering the very best performance.
Tell me, how did you qualify for your job?
Well, like all RCA service company technicians, I received thorough training in RCA factory methods by RCA engineers.
And how long ago did you finish your training?
My training is never really finished, Vaughn. To keep up with my job, I still attend periodic clinics on current advances in electronics. We RCA service company technicians service only RCA Victor television. And that's why we know your RCA Victor television set best.
RCA service company branches are located in most TV areas. Look for the one nearest you under television service in your classified directory.
And now, NBC News presents Jerome Kern, the man and the music, a biography in sound. Your narrator is Kenneth Banghart.
Jerome David Kern, born 1885, died 1945, just 10 years ago this month.
During his span of 60 years, the world did everything but turn inside out. It staggered from horse-drawn carriage to jet-propelled plane, through two global wars, a major depression, and a host of lesser mishaps. In all this chaos, the melodies of Jerome Kern have not only survived, they've become a sort of ideal standard for later composers of popular music to aim at. And nowadays, when someone says they don't write music like that anymore, he may unconsciously be paying his respects to Jerome Kern, an owlish little man in horn-rimmed glasses who, as Andre Castellanos put it, looked less a musician than any man I've ever known. Perhaps the mere statistics indicate the power of his impact. Kern was the composer of melodies for more than 50 musical comedies, and at the time of his death, at least 15 of his songs had passed the 2 million mark in record sales. But statistics are only the outer garment of a man's genius. For the full story, you must look at the man himself and at the boy behind the man.
Well, it just happened that I was brought up in Elmhurst, Long Island, with Jerome Kern.
That's Joseph Myron, the son of an actor who was very popular just at the turn of the century. Today, Joseph Myron runs a hotel down in Nassau in the British West Indies. In 1897, he was one of Jerome Kern's neighborhood pals.
Jerry was a wistful, sensitive kid whose only interest seemed to be music. He was very, very nervous type and very retiring. And in the schoolyard, he was always in a lot of trouble because there were a lot of antagonistic boys there and everything could make fun of a little fellow like that. The kids at school used to gang up on him, the bullies around the schoolyard, and some of us protected him because we respected his piano playing. My father gave me a good allowance, and I used to turn it into candy and bribe the bullies with nuggets of sweetness to keep him from getting a bloody nose.
That candy, in the light of after events, was well invested. After high school, Jerry Kern studied at the New York College of Music, where he was a good but not a brilliant student. And then after a rather unsuccessful fling at the family's furniture business, his father saw the wisdom of additional music study, this time in Europe. Kern sailed in 1903. It was in London he met the American producer Charles Frohman. Guy Bolton, later to become a Kern collaborator and film biographer, remembers what happened next.
Jerry had tried during his quite early beginnings in New York to get to see Frohman. He never was able to obtain an introduction to him. And Frohman at that time was completely sold on doing English shows, both musicals and straight plays. And after Jerry had gone to England, he had written a number. There, Charles Frohman heard the number and asked to meet Jerry and made a proposal to him that he should come to America with him and write extra numbers. He said that you Englishmen have a way of writing this type of number so much better than any of our boys do, and I'd like to have you over there. So Jerry didn't disillusion him on the matter of his being an Englishman and sailed with him. And when they reached New York, Frohman, rather proudly pointing out sights as they came up the harbor, saying, "That's the Statue of Liberty, and that building with the gold dome on it is the World Building," when a woman came up to Jerry and said, "I've been in my cabin all the way over, and I didn't know you were here. And how are your family out in Newark?"
Frohman, they say, got a big kick out of Jerry's deception and his embarrassment at being found out, for they later became good friends. Temporarily, though, Kern had to take a job on Tin Pan Alley, not as a composer, but as a pianist. And it was there he met his first American collaborator.
I guess I had the relative part in his career that the Tin Lizzy had in the career of the Ford automobile.
Edward Lasker, 21 years old at the time we're talking about, and already a lad with a growing reputation.
I dropped in to see a producer who had a show just opened out of town, at which I'd written practically the song here, an Indian song called Sweet Little Caribou. And I asked him if he needed anything for the show. He said, yes, I want a duet for Joe Myron. I can see the idea of writing a sort of a burlesque song around the Wade Spoon. And I got to the Palms. There was Jerry playing away. Jerry, I said, we've got a song to do. I've been in to see Paley, and he wants us to do a duet. And I got the idea that How Would You Like to Spoon With Me would be an idea, and then to write humorous burlesque lyrics to it. Great, he said. Well, what have you got? So he took the title and he pushed it around for about 5 minutes and had a corking melody. Okay, I said, shoot me a verse, and back came a verse, and just as long as it takes to play it now. So I went home, wrote the lyric that evening, next day, down to Kane. We rehearsed, over to Paley. Some women came in after us, and the office boy, we let them in before us, and Kane was very uppish. He said, come on, we'll go over to Alf Heyman. So I told the girl we'd be back later, went over to Alf Heyman. He was Froman's general manager. He liked the song, and he said the White Spoon wouldn't be understood in London. I said, well, that's really the crux of the song, but I'll see what I can do overnight. We got out on the street, and Jerry said, no, we wouldn't change the way. I said, let's go over to Schubert's. We went over to Schubert's, and they were rehearsing Eddie Foy to be starred in The Air and the Girl. Sam Schubert came out, and Jerry said, Mr. Schubert, we're proteges of Reginald de Koven. I was more surprised than Schubert because I didn't know who we were until then. So Schubert took us right into a piano. Jerry played, I sang, and Sam Schubert was wild about it. He said, we'll feature it in The Air and the Girl immediately.
How'd You Like to Spoon With Me became Kern's first big song hit. After it was written, Lasker went on to become a successful songwriter and dramatist, and Kern continued his search for a publisher. Robert Russell Bennett, who later became Kern's arranger and close friend, takes up the story.
There was a Mr. Max Dreyfuss, who is quite a powerful man in the world of light music, and to be in with the Dreyfuss brothers was a great feather in any composer's cap. And finally, Kern made it. Some friends got him in to see Mr. Dreyfuss. When he went into the office, now bear in mind that this is a long, long time ago, he went into the office of the Dreyfuss brothers, and he saw on the piano a silk hat and a stick, walking stick, and the gentlemen in the office were all dressed in frock coats. Well, that impressed Jerome B. Kern very, very much, and he went back to his wife, and he said, my, this is a high-class organization. I'm certainly glad that I'm in a place like that. It's really the big leagues. But he found out about 3 weeks later that the whole outfit had been out to play a wedding that afternoon and they were dressed accordingly.
The Dreyfuss brothers, it might be added, soon found it unnecessary to balance the budget by playing at weddings, thanks in part to their new property, Jerome Kern. At this date, though, Broadway producers were not ready to trust Kern with a score for an entire show. But he did find a way to get a foot in the door. Guy Bolton remembers it well.
It was the custom then. They were putting on all these Austrian musical comedies, and they always wanted a couple of American hit numbers in them. And the other songwriters used to try and find out ahead of time, listen at the doors and employ a grapevine to discover when one of these things was going to be done. But Jerry wouldn't do that. He'd wait till they'd been rehearsing for a couple of weeks. And then he would turn up at the rehearsal with the portfolio under his arm and say, do you want any numbers? And they would say, no, we've got all the interpolated numbers we need. And he said, oh, it's too bad. I had something that I thought would interest you. By this time, they were quite tired. And they would say, sit down at the piano and play. And in those days, he played very well. So he'd perform these numbers, and they would throw some other number out and put one of Kern's in. Very crafty dodge.
Among those interpolated songs was one Kern wrote for the girl from Utah. The title, They Didn't Believe Me.
Thank you.
By now, the name Jerome Kern was becoming familiar in New York professional circles. It became more so when he began to write, with Guy Bolton and P.G. Woodhouse, a series of unique musical shows for the Princess Theater. The shows were successful, and so were the Kern melodies. A theatrical triumvirate had been born. Here's a notation on that subject from the scrapbook of P.G. Woodhouse.
This is what George Kaufman wrote in FPA's column. This is the trio of musical fame, Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern. Better than anyone else you can name, Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern. Nobody knows what on earth they've been bitten by. All I can say is I mean to get litten by orchestra seats for the next one that's written by Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern.
In these years, Kern's name appeared frequently in the copy of Broadway columnists. It also showed up quite often on the passenger lists of ships headed for Europe. On one of these occasions, he was set to go with Charles Frohman, the producer who had imported Kern from England just 10 years earlier. Guy Bolton.
Frohman asked him to go back to England with him. And Jerry arranged to do so. He went to a party the night before he was going to sail, when a lot of friends were wishing him well and drinks were flowing quite freely. And he had left an order to be called very early in the morning, and he had asked them to wake him at 6. And he woke up about that time, but wasn't called. However, that didn't disturb him very much. He started to get dressed, and while he was dressing, it kept getting darker and darker, and he became convinced that it was going to be a dreadful day, and a horrible day in which to sail away from New York. And he went downstairs with a couple of bags, got in a taxi, and said to the taxi driver, "What's happening to the weather?" The taxi driver said, "What's wrong with it?" And he said, "Well, it's getting so dark." He said, "It should get dark. It's nearly 7 o'clock. Jerry had slept right through the day, and by doing so, he missed sailing with Frohman on Frohman's last voyage on the Lusitania.
On May 17th, 1915, just a few miles off the Irish